Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Welcome, everyone, to the newest edition of the Mormon Matters Podcast. I'm your host, Dan Weatherspoon, and I'm really thrilled to have two great guests with me today. One is a familiar voice, Christine Haglund, who's back for us again. She's the editor of Dialogue, and the reason we've got her, besides the fact that she's brilliant and well-spoken and a great theologian, is that she edited a fantastic article by our second guest, who is Taylor Petrie. And it is from the Winter 2011 Dialogue, and it is called Post-Heterosexual Mormon Theology. Let me just quickly frame something for a second, then we'll have each of our two guests, you know, say a little bit about their background. But as I was looking through Mormon Matters podcast history, we've been going now for about 13 months, we've never done a show on LDS views of homosexuality. It certainly will come up in the various pieces of certain conversations, but we've never directly addressed it. I know John over at Mormon Stories has done it a lot, and we now have a new podcast that's about to be launched with Michael Ferguson as the host called Gay Mormon Stories. And those are the personal accounts, and there's lots of wonderful areas that we need to jump into when it comes to, you know, hearing voices and learning compassion and recognizing that this is not a choice, that these are not, you know, driven by things other than, you know, wholehearted identity. But then there's, you know, a role that Mormon Matters will often play is to try to have the high-level theoretical discussion of things. And that's been missing, and that's what this article supplies. And I'm really thrilled for just the three of us to have a really great discussion today. You know, if we're going to look at our theology as Mormonism, there's some strength and there's some weaknesses in it. But I think, Taylor, the way you come down and the way I think we'll end here then, is I think we're going to find that there's lots of historical things that have gone on in the Mormon past in terms of thinking about gender and spirit identity and whatnot. And we have a lot of rich resources for actually taking a look at homosexuality in a new way and getting us oriented in terms of what would be the obstacles in terms of thought patterns and whatnot that are standing in the way. So if you don't mind, let's just have each of you quickly introduce yourselves. Christine, would you remind our viewers about your background and a little bit about where you live and all that good stuff?
Sure. My name's Christine Haglund, and I have a couple of completely irrelevant degrees in German studies and German literature, and I live outside of Boston with my three children, only two of whom are taller than I am so far.
Cool. And you are the editor of Dialogue for 3.5, 4 years
yes.
now?
Yes, since my first issue was the spring 2009, so I started working on that in the middle of 2008.
Great, and you're doing a wonderful job there. Everyone I know is thrilled with Dialogue, and we are grateful to have you back.
Thanks.
Taylor Petrie, you've been in my consciousness for 8 or 10 years as this brilliant guy at Harvard forever, and I'm not making a comment on how long it took you to get a degree or anything, but just like this name of this guy. I finally met you about 4 or 5 years ago when we were back there for a Sunstone. But tell us about the whole background of your upbringing or whatnot, at least clues into it, and then a bit into your degrees and where you're teaching and things now.
Sure. So I was born at a very early age. That's my dad's joke.
Your dad's bad joke.
I grew up in South Jordan, Utah, is where I went to high school and so on, and went off to New York City for my undergraduate. After my mission, I came back and decided that I wanted to major in religion, and had a really wonderful experience doing that at Pace University. Went on to graduate school at Harvard for a master's first, and then a doctorate of theology, and finished that in 2010. I was happy that Bill Barlow was the first active Latter-day Saint to finish a doctorate of theology at Harvard, and I was the second one, so there was a long gap there for a long time.
Wow, no kidding.
And I work primarily in early Christianity, New Testament in early Christianity, and now I'm a professor of religion at Kalamazoo College in Michigan, where I teach early Christianity, biblical studies, ancient Judaism, and classes about the theory of religion and so on. And next year I'm going to be taking on the chair as the head, or I guess as the chair of Women, Gender, and Sexuality program that we've got here too. So that's a little bit about my background, I guess.
Right, and your dissertation relates a bit, at least, to the categories, some of the categories and some of the things we're going to talk about today. Do you want to share what that is and trying to get that out as a book?
Yeah. So I'm currently revising my dissertation into a book manuscript, and it deals with sexuality and gender in the resurrection in the way that early Christians thought about it. So that's the one-sentence introduction to it, I suppose.
Yeah, so these issues have been on your mind and studying them for a long time.
Yeah.
Well, let's begin a little bit. Taylor, maybe you can just begin by letting us know how this article started percolating in your brain and sort of the process of putting it together and then sending it off to Christine, and just sort of let's begin with the story of how this one came to be.
Sure. Well, you know, this is that it had been a topic of conversation, I think, obviously, among a lot of Latter-day Saints for a long time. And the idea of thinking about a Latter-day Saint solution to the problem that same-sex relationships pose theologically is just something that had kind of been rolling around in my head. Obviously, you know, the 2008 election season was one where the issue kind of came to the forefront for many Latter-day Saints, including myself. And really just kind of had a moment where I felt like, oh, that's an interesting solution. That's an interesting idea. So I wrote up a really quick outline. I think I called it initially an outline, or I think I called it a prolegomena to a future of post-heterosexual theology or something like that. Just really kind
of... Yeah, you picked the snottier word, prolegomena.
Yeah, just kind of picked it. And it was very short. And I sent it off to Christine and said, would you consider publishing something like this? And I was actually initially thinking about publishing it anonymously for various reasons. And she gave me some really good, useful feedback. I think that I got some readers' reports on it and so forth, too. And kind of sat on it then, I think, for about a year or so, probably, before I came back to it and beefed it up. I think it ended up being about two-thirds longer than it originally had been, and tried to provide some real more, you know, contextual background to some of what had initially just been a very brief snapshot of some ideas, and eventually changed my mind under the advice of some friends that I should publish it under my own name, and Christine graciously agreed to publish it. So that's kind of the background.
Christine, anything on your side?
Well, I'll just say I really liked his initial draft and almost was ready to publish it, and then spent some more time thinking about it and realized that I had exactly one time to get this laid out. That, you know, we really haven't approached the theology, and I was afraid that if we just did a rough sketch that was going to, you know, set the direction of the discussion, and it might get scattered too quickly. And so anyway, I was really pleased that Taylor decided to go ahead and flesh it out a little bit and get this discussion started in a really rich way that he did. And I was also really glad, I don't know all the reasons behind the decision to publish it with his name, but I'm definitely happy that we did it that way. There are too many articles in church publications of all kinds about homosexuality with name withheld as the author, so I'm really happy that this is not contributing to that genre.
Great. And Taylor, has there been any negative repercussions so far or any notice? And then hopefully this podcast won't send any negative stuff to your way. But
Not anything that I'm particularly concerned about. You know, some people really have enjoyed it. And I would say the vast majority of people who have read it and who have engaged with it have given me positive feedback. I have received a few negative responses, but that were not particularly... You know, definitely people have been critical of the article in productive ways, but there have been some people who have been critical in unproductive ways, but nothing that I'm particularly concerned about. I think I stayed clear of most of the lines that might get somebody in trouble on this issue, and so I think that I don't have anything to worry about.
Great. And, you know, that actually leads to a nice little way to jump into this. I love your initial framing, those first few paragraphs of the article, where you're saying, look, this is a thought experiment. This is a discover, you know, this is a discussion starter. And you really do shy away in the piece from actually saying any kind of advocacy. You just are sort of laying out the issues and whatnot. So do you mind either of you reflecting a little bit on the decision to make that, like you say, a framing, or would you guys call it a rough outline, or doing it this way versus, you know, sort of doing the advocacy theology that we often see a lot of?
Well, I think that I have benefited from the lessons learned of a number of scholars who have gone before me, and a number of people who have sort of trotted out what the lines and found out through trial and error a little bit what the lines are that you can and cannot cross. And I think that, trying to tell the church leaders what they should do or what they need to do or what they must do are one of those things that it's not only not going to work, but it's in many ways been counterproductive. So I hope to have learned from that lesson. I'm grateful for those who in many ways have suffered those consequences before me and others like me who want to ask critical questions and serious questions about church teachings. So I'm grateful for what they've done, but I also hope that we can have a more engaged conversation with church leadership and other members of the church that avoid some of those kind of hot button lines that you can't cross. So,
yeah, terrific. Christine, any thoughts on the tradition of speculative theology or anything that is sort of exploratory in nature?
Sure. I think I would frame it maybe even more devotionally with the idea that we are supposed to study things out in our mind before we expect to get revelation. And it seems to me that this issue is so thorny and so fraught, and that our current answers are in many ways unsatisfying, and that, you know, if ever we needed new revelation and if ever a revelatory tradition were the one that could best address a problem that's vexing to all kinds of faith traditions and theologies, that, you know, that this is one of those questions where we really do need more. And that means that, you know, that we do need to be studying it, but also that a certain humility is really a prerequisite for learning. And, you know, I think it's right to recognize that in our church, intellectuals may help with the process of sorting through issues and coming to the new questions, but that we really do respect a different source for definitive answers, and that it's just, you know, not only unproductive or dangerous, but not Mormon for scholars to advocate their own theological answers as definitive in any way. And so I really like the way that Taylor has approached this as, you know, as a scholar who thinks about these questions and as a Latter-day Saint who is deeply concerned about these questions and their implications for some of our brothers and sisters and, you know, and for us as we try to be Christians. But, you know, with always the background knowledge that, you know, that our answers that we don't get to answer the questions, that we get to ask them, and that we try to ask the best possible questions we can and then wait and listen.
Cool. I like that a lot. Thank you. Taylor, let's dive into your article. It is a fantastically framed piece. As you were talking about the story of these things coming up in your mind and, you know, kind of writing down things, I had been sort of doing that on my own through the years, thinking, you know, one of the things that will absolutely have to be cleared away, at least, or thought through more carefully with Mormonism is the idea of eternal gender of spirits. So, you know, I'd already been putting that one together in my head. I also been thinking of, you know, there's this sort of theological tradition of God as a divine couple creating spirit bodies, that there was some sort of sexual reproduction at least has been there. But I knew that that area was a little bit thin. Somehow we were probably putting too much weight on two or three different things. And then you came up with a third category to explore in your article, which is about kinship. And I have to say, I hadn't really been thinking about that, but I found it to be extremely fascinating. So do you mind just taking us through the three categories? So basically, listeners, the first thing that Taylor does in his thing is he talks about spirit children and spirit birth and how spirits are created. interested and sort of ask the really good questions, like Christine says, that's the job, to ask the really good questions about that. Then he explores kinship and relationships and the different theological resources and the good questions to ask for Mormons in that area. And then third, he talks a lot about gender and sexual dimorphism and social roles and all those different things that also come into play in a major way in these discussions about same-sex stuff. But Taylor, would you take us into those three things? But, you know, it just dawned on me as I'm talking, you probably ought to do a little bit about why you chose to talk about not same-sex attraction so much as same-sex relationships.
Yeah.
So let's do that first, but then feel free to drive us right into that first of the three categories dealing with spirit birth.
Sure. Well, just on that last point that you mentioned, I think that that's one of the areas where we have most misunderstood what's going on here. You know, when I read about the way that many Latter-day Saints are, or hear the way that many Latter-day Saints seem to think about homosexuality, homosexual relationships, is that it is defined primarily by the kinds of sex that people are having. And I think that this is a misunderstanding, and in some ways this has to do with the term homosexual, as you know, sex seems to be right in the word there. And I think that this ends up being ultimately a misunderstanding of what's happening. And the real problem for Latter-day Saint theology is not the kind of sex that people are having, but the fact that there is the reality of non-heterosexual families, non-heterosexual relationships out there. How do these, or can they, fit into Latter-day Saint theology? And this, for me, started as a sort of a real theological problem. Other traditions have, scripture is maybe the barrier there, and how do you deal with what Paul says about it in Romans chapter 1 or Leviticus or so on? And, you know, various traditions have come down on this issue in various ways, and this is, you know, clearly one of the issues that has occupied American Christian churches over the last two decades in significant ways, and in often very contentious ways in those churches as well. But for us, for Latter-day Saints, the problem isn't just about how do you interpret scripture or something like that, but the whole structure of the cosmos seems to be sort of centered around heterosexuality. You mentioned, you know, God and Mrs. God as sort of the ideal heterosexual couple, and our whole tradition seems to be sort of based on this whole idea that heterosexual families are the heavenly type of family as well. But in looking into this a little bit, I felt like our own traditions didn't fully support this particular framing of what the cosmos is like, and so it's sort of in this article attempt to sort of reread them and point to a number of different possibilities that might emerge out of our own traditions, our own texts, that might point to some other ways of thinking about what families might look like, what kinds of saving relationships we might imagine. Of course, along the way, there are still some problems that need to be thought out through this process, and I alert people to some of those that I hope more people will keep thinking about. And in some ways, as I say, this is sort of the beginning of a conversation on this topic, but really starting from the idea that we're talking about people's relationships, not people's sexual practices per se. You know?
Yeah, I think that's terrific, and it really broadens it in the right way, and it also brings into the fact that we do have a lot of talk about relationships within Mormonism that we can kind of draw on. And there's this question I've been having, you know, I want to ask you, maybe I'll ask it later or again too, but it seems like Mormonism in many ways, we're just beginning the discussion here with homosexuality, but we've been exploring different forms of relationality probably more than pretty much any other tradition I can ever think of. Would you say that? Yeah, so we kind of have this wide palette.
Yeah, I mean, the idea that heaven is a social place, you know, and Joseph Smith's revelations along these lines that same sociality which exists here will exist among us there.
Right.
The idea of relationships are really the foundation of our notion of salvation, our notion of what our church life is like. So, yeah, I mean, I think that thinking productively and creatively about those relationships is kind of the main job of theology.
Very good, yeah. Christine, anything before we jump right into making spirit babies?
Oh, let's get right to the making babies. I don't want to place any impediments in the way of that.
Okay. Well, Taylor, you did some fascinating work in this area. At one point in it, you said that you considered as thin our theology or thin canonical support for the idea that many Mormons seem to be carrying with them, that whatever processes by which spirits are born and are said to be truly children of the divine parents, that there's some sort of heterosexual relationships involved with that. We don't talk about it, but it seems like it's an assumption there. But you said it's kind of thin canonical support for it. So let's just begin with clearing some cobwebs. What is the support? What are the statements that sort of need to be wrestled with? And then you do a brilliant job of kind of expanding us into that area of you know, different pieces. So I'll just let you riff for a while, and we'll just jump in as we need to.
Sure. Well, you know, the sort of basic story that's been told about the history of our doctrine of the spirit birth, and it's definitely a little bit more complicated than this, but the idea that Joseph Smith's notions were that we were eternal intelligences, and we've always coexisted alongside God. Brigham Young later taught that we were born spiritually by God, and in order to sort of emphasize our genetic relationship with God, and that our spirits were born. These two sort of different doctrines, understandings of human origins, are reconciled by B.H. Roberts and others, who argue that our intelligences are eternal, but our spirits are born from God. And so this analogy that just as in our mortal bodies, our spirit enters into our mortal bodies at the time of our physical birth, the idea was that our intelligence enters into our spiritual bodies at the time of our spiritual birth. So in a lot of ways, this is actually a relatively late doctrine to Mormonism, and one that there's a lot of tension in the 19th century, at least, over. But I look at this issue, and I look at this as being one of the fundamental reasons for rejecting homosexual relationships as it's understood in Mormonism, the idea that reproduction is sort of the central aspect of what marriages and relationships are about. And I look at a number of different options of kind of thinking about reproduction differently, especially divine reproduction. The most obvious ones, of course, are in Genesis itself, where it doesn't say anything about divine reproduction being the cause of either Adam's spirit or Adam's body. Instead, Jesus and God by themselves, without any, at least in the canonical tradition and even in other sacred traditions to Mormonism, there are no females present at all. They are perfectly capable of making human bodies without the help of somebody of the other gender. And there are a number of other instances, like the virgin birth, where there's no male penetration into Mary, but there's a child is created. So there are a number of different places that we can look in our own scriptural tradition, and even in our Latter-day Saint tradition, which doesn't require heterosexual coupling as the basis of creation. So assuming that spirit birth is a doctrine that we want to accept in Mormonism, the idea that it has to sort of be heterosexual doesn't seem to be supported so much in the texts and traditions that we've got. So that's one area of kind of looking at it, rethinking the notion of spirit birth as the basis for heterosexuality.
Okay, but so in the scriptures, you're right, and you also mentioned somewhere in there about creating Eve out of, you know, Adam's own body, and so we have all this in the scripture, and you're basically saying zero to to very little canonical stuff, and then you've kind of given us a little history of Brigham Young and B.H. Roberts and doing all that. Where, though, it seemed to me that there was a few key phrases that came along. Emphasized the natural way. You know, it would be a very close analogy to the way babies are made here. It seems like those are the things that I'll hear. Somebody will say, "Well, so and so said it's basically the same process."
Yeah,
and a lot of people celebrate the fact that, you know, divine sex. You know, hey, great,
right.
Christine,
right.
Maybe not so happy. Divine pregnancy. You know, but
yeah, no, I was actually going to say, quite seriously, this is one place where it's unfortunate, I think, that women are not involved in the official articulation of doctrine, because I think that even, you know, the most orthodox women I know, you know, who would happily accept, you know, general authority statements about almost anything as authoritative, absolutely reject the notion that they will spend eternity pregnant with spirit children. I mean, either either they make jokes about it or, you know, they're sort of incensed about the idea that this is could even be a possibility. I mean, I think that the idea that something like human pregnancy and gestation would continue for the eternities is repugnant to almost all Mormon women, sort of regardless of where they are on the orthodoxy spectrum about other questions. And so it's interesting that I think that the theology that maybe many men carry around in their heads, the sort of folk theology or the unexamined notions about sexuality in the afterlife, are very different between men and women. And we don't often talk about that because it's uncomfortable or we sort of laugh it off, you know, with dumb jokes about eternal pregnancy, but it's one place where I think that gender matters in other ways than the ones that Taylor's talking about here.
Yeah. So, and Taylor, you even make it even more explicit than Christine did when you talk about, does this mean there's divine sperm involved? Right. Does this mean there's menstruation during the times that, you know, Heavenly Mother is not pregnant? Is there, you know, you talked again about a gestational period and things like that Christine did touch on there.
Do you have to breastfeed spirit babies? As well?
Yeah. So with what Christine just said, it's happening sort of at the anecdotal conversational level. You make it explicit here. I think that most people, as they really do begin to think about this, are going to reject all those things. So I want to hear anything you want to say on that, but I also want to kind of hear what are the statements that just sort of need to be challenged that kind of point us in this direction?
Well, I think that most of them that I can recall off the top of my head are sort of Brigham Young or Brigham Young era ones. There are certainly ones after that maintain that there is. I think Talmadge has some stuff about there being sex in the afterlife and so on. There are, you know, ones by Joseph Fielding Smith about how the people who are in the celestial, the highest level of the celestial kingdom, will actually have their genitals, but everybody else won't.
Right.
You know, there's some really interesting doctrines in there as well. So it's been kind of a long tradition, but I think that, you know, along the lines of what Christine has said, many people have actually been very shy about saying anything really concrete about it. You know, I think the most concrete thing that's been said is what you alluded to, something along the lines of, just as it happens here, it will happen there. But of course, people aren't incredibly comfortable with that idea because it does strike somebody as a little embarrassing, perhaps, as kind of biologically literalist in certain ways that people aren't always comfortable with. So I'm not sure that it's something that we need to continue to emphasize, particularly given that we have this alternative tradition about the eternity of our intelligences. But even if it is, you know, there are other problems that I mentioned in the article too, that, you know, the idea that resurrected, glorified bodies are giving birth to bodies which are two levels below their state of progression doesn't really make all that much sense. Why exactly does a spirit body need to be born from a resurrected body? And of course, resurrected bodies don't need to be born from resurrected bodies. They can just be created and just sort of be organized. Material can be reorganized. So we have all kinds of ways of thinking about creation, thinking about birth, thinking about, you know, the organization of material without thinking it as sort of the result of sexual intercourse.
Right, good. Let's go into those alternate ways of thinking of how we could say that God and God... Christine, tell me, what should I say? Should I say God and Heavenly Mother? Should I say the divine couple? What's a good preferred way to really make sure that we're talking about two always?
Well, I mean, even that is complicated, right? Because are we talking about a divine couple or a divine polygamous relationship? Well, I would just say God. Well, I don't know. I don't have a solution for you. Divine couple is probably as good as anything.
All right, we'll call it the divine couple. All right. So what are the other alternatives then, Taylor, for the divine couple to still be said they are the parents of our spirits? We're literally the offspring of gods.
Mm-hmm.
And I think maybe in doing it, you talked about two levels below. Let's just clarify. You're talking about the level at some point that B.H. Roberts seemed to articulate that we were intelligences, mm-hmm. and then became divine spirits, or mm-hmm. divine spirits and spirit bodies, who then had mortal bodies, who then had resurrected bodies. So those mm-hmm. are the four levels, and that's why you were saying two levels below.
Right, right. Thank you for clarifying that, yeah.
So yeah. So take us through the other alternate models other than divine sex.
Well, you know, we have lots of traditions in the scriptures, of course. Even Paul really articulates a theory of adoption, that all those who have faith can become the children of Abraham. You know, so the idea of sort of direct lines, bloodlines, lineage lines are not all that important. They're sort of symbolic lines, right? That's not to say that we can't think of ourselves as actual gods in embryo, right? But it doesn't necessarily require that we have, you know, that we sort of were the product of divine sperm and divine egg or something like that, right? So we can think about the other metaphors that we have, the other ways of talking about creation as the organization of matter unformed, as the calling together of, you know, all of the spirits or intelligences in the premortal existence and those who chose to follow God's plan on one side and those who don't. And we have lots of ways of thinking about our kinship, our filiation with God that, you know, are not reducible to sort of reproduction.
Yeah, good. So those are good. Some, yeah. Those are good. And again, I have a strong desire myself personally, and I think there is this strong desire within Mormonism to be, you know, to literally, and I think we do it in some ways better than anything else by saying we're uncreated, you know, co-eternal with God stuff, but we really emphasize truly sons and daughters, children of God, where other traditions, when God creates from nothing and there's the creator-creature dichotomy, Mormonism has this strong desire to really keep that language of children of God. And so I love that you've now helped, you know, begin the conversation where somebody in this listening audience is going to be hearing this in you know, Sunday school class, or it'll come up somewhere along the lines, and they'll be able to say, you know what, let's complicate this, but still have the other positive alternatives to sort of
right.
Make it work. So the second section you're taking us into is, as I mentioned kind of in my own little story of you writing the article that I was halfway dreaming about, or at least, you know, playing with these theological things, and I'm so glad that you did it. I mean, you had all the materials and stuff that I couldn't even have come close to digging into.
I hope that you'll contribute in some way to yourself, too.
I want to, because, well, and I'll share an angle that, in fact, it will be on the gendered spirits section. But the second section was fascinating to me, where you just really took some time to educate us all on kinship and kinship systems and different ways that groups affiliate with each other, and certainly sexual reproduction and things was one of them, but it was only one of them. And so I'd love to have you just really educate us here for the next little bit about this beautiful section that, again, we have rich Mormon resources.
Well, for me, the category of kinship, and in some ways even the vocabulary word itself, was that key. That was that aha moment for me. It's like, oh, wait a second. Again, we're thinking about families here, right? When we're talking about people getting married, we're talking about the creation of a family. What do those families look like? So the question here, and the way that I've seen sort of the political debates over gay marriage sort of centering on precisely this question, is what is a family? What can be called a family? And thinking anthropologically about the variety of different ways that, you know, human beings affiliate, that families are created, or the kinship relationships are created, not only in foreign cultures, but even in our own country, the way that many grandparents and second generation, grandparents will raise grandchildren, and there are all different kinds of ways of organizing families and who gets to be counted in those families. So thinking about the way that same-sex partners create families, not just oftentimes not just with themselves, but with children as well, either through adoption or children from previous relationships. These are families that exist. And again, thinking about our emphasis in Latter-day Saint theology and Latter-day Saint tradition on the idea of making families eternal, is there a way, and I look to some resources within Mormonism. Is there a way to sort of make these kinds of families count as families or within Mormon ideas? So I look at the ways in which, going back to this issue of reproduction, the ways in which reproduction has not always been sort of the defining feature, characteristic of Latter-day Saint practices of sealing, and look to the 19th century, particularly around the what was called the law of adoption that sealed many adult men and women to other adult men and women. And these were not about creating reproductive relationships, either reproductive relationships in the modern world as it is now, nor, of course, reproductive relationships in the celestial sphere. They were about creating a new kind of family, a new kind of divine family. And they weren't concerned with reproduction as being sort of the thing that brought those families together. And of course, we still practice adoption today, and in our sealing rituals we practice adoption today. And reproduction isn't, again, in that circumstance, the thing that allows people to get sealed together. So again, the idea that same-sex couples cannot naturally reproduce, which has been one of the arguments that's been used against why they can't be sealed, is not the logic that sort of governs the way that we have practiced sealings in the past, nor really even in the present. So I point to the ways that kinship, the way that family networks are created outside of the norms of reproduction, as kind of the ways in which we might think of how same-sex couples might also be counted as kin, counted as family.
Yeah, terrific. I'm remembering something, and I should have looked it up. I can't complain because I only thought of it a minute ago. But wasn't there some line in Richard Bushman's Rough Stone Rolling about Joseph Smith, and when it came to the polygamy section or something, he didn't think that he was so much looking for wives as, or something like he really wanted kin.
Yeah.
I can't remember what the phrase was. Did either of you remember it?
Not off the top of my head, but there are a number of quotes from him where the idea, and in fact, he actually even argues at one point, I can't remember if this made it into the final version of my essay or not, but that the thing that unites humanity is not families per se, but it's friendships, right?
Yeah.
So he thought of all these new kinds of ways of sort of organizing and ordering society that were not reducible to reproductive relationships at all. So I don't think that we need to think of reproduction as the sine qua non of what a family is. You
know? Right, right. And this section is rich and wonderful, but it isn't the one that really we mostly stumble on, I think, at least when people say, oh, there's so many theological obstacles to affirm, to making room for these types of relationships in the eternities. This isn't the area, but I know, Christine, you found this section really, really rich. Would you share some things and, whatever you want to bring in, as well as whatever you'd want to ask Taylor to flesh out more?
Yeah, I want to ask Taylor a little bit. I mean, it seems to me that in a way, Joseph Smith's concern and interest in kinship fits well with what we have from the early Christian church, particularly from Paul, who seems to really emphasize the bonds of saints as sort of becoming new brothers and sisters, this new sibling relationship in Christ, sort of superseding tribal and, other kinds of familial relations. I just want to see if you want to play with that at all. We think of Joseph Smith's Restoration of All Things as having to do more with Old Testament ideas, but I see this focus on kinship as really sort of echoing things from the New Testament.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that the language that we still use in the church today of brother and sister, that when we're baptized into the church, we become a part of a family where we're all brothers and sisters. It certainly is a kind of utopian vision that governed early Christian social organization, and obviously one that continues to be influential for our tradition as well. So I definitely think that there are ways in which the redefinition of what counts as family is fundamental to what the early Christian message is about, and even what early Mormonism is about. I mean, it's its own utopian visions of society experiment with lots of different kinds of kinship organization, of course, including polygamy and others. And so, yeah, the kind of redefinition and binding people together broadly as kinship, going back to that Joseph Smith quote about friendship, he actually says that it is through friendship that we become kin, or that kinship is expanded, something along those lines. So, yeah, definitely seeing those
sorts of bonds that exist within those communities, both in early Mormonism and today as kind of becoming a new family, is very much a part of the way that we organize ourselves.
Cool. So back to the question of same-sex relationships. This is plenty of room for you because you're basically saying we don't exclusively limit the things that we do in our temples and whatnot to biological stuff. And so that would be the only objection, at least at this point, for same-sex couples would be if there was an essential biological element, and you're saying Mormon theology is way beyond that.
Yeah, you know, I mean, we don't have a procreationist perspective on what sexual relationships are about. We don't require that people be, you know, pass a sort of reproduction test before they're allowed to be sealed.
Right.
You know, lots of people get married and sealed long after their fertile years. You know, the idea that one needs to be in a demonstrably reproductive relationship in order to be sealed seems like it's not practiced, of course, for mixed sex couples, and that there really shouldn't be any reason why we need to enforce that on same sex couples should we ever change our policy on this. So, yeah, I think that the logic of reproduction, and this is an argument that's made in the Divine Institution of Marriage, which is the sort of church's official paper that was produced in the 2008 election cycle, that's still available on the church's website, is the idea of sort of natural reproduction of children as the basis of what marriage is all about. And I think we need to interrogate that idea because it's not entirely consistent with our own tradition as it's practiced. So.
Terrific. Christine, take us even deeper. What else you got on kinship?
Well, I was going to say, this will take us into the next section a little bit. One of the things that I think is really difficult that is more of a problem than, you know, whether homosexual couples are second, is that I do think there's something important in Mormon theology about things being a compound in one and everything having, you know, a binary opposite that is held in, you know, fruitful paradox by gospel principles and by the principle of agency. And so there is something, I mean, Taylor argues against a strictly binary understanding of gender, and his arguments are in some ways very persuasive, but I think lots of other Mormons would want to hold on to some special place for the heterosexual dyad, you know, for this place where opposites, the poles of gender, are reconciled and held together in relationship. And so this notion of kinship, I think, allows the preservation of the specialness of that dyad while not excluding every other possibility. And so I like that about it, that it has these broad possibilities.
Thank you. Christine, I think you're absolutely right that one of the things that our tradition does is suggest that we are saved as, you know, couples or as communities or as families, that there's a sense of individual salvation is not really a part of our tradition so much. You know, we're saved, of course, individually, but also very much in relationship with other people. And what kinship does, I think what this category of kinship, as opposed to sort of the heterosexual family, is give us other kinds of relationships that can accomplish that same goal. So,
yeah, and I think the other, you know, obvious and important thing about maybe learning to incorporate that understanding more into our sort of quotidian discussion of Mormonism is that, you know, the vast majority of contemporary Latter-day Saints do not fit in what is described as the ideal family. You know, they don't live with, you know, a husband and wife who are married and have children in their home. We have huge numbers of people who are, you know, never married or who are divorced or, you know, whose spouses are not Mormon and so they are not sealed. And so this ideal actually fits a really pretty small fraction of people who are attracted to Mormon doctrine. And it ends up that we lose people by our intensive focus on this one particular model of heterosexual family. And, you know, it's really unnecessary, I think. And if we could take this notion of kinship more seriously and link it more with our discussion of temple, you know, for instance, if the young women, instead of sort of constantly being told to think about making it to the temple, for marriage, we're told to think about making it to the temple to be bound to the body of the saints, to become part of the body of Christ in this particular covenant way, you would ease a lot of the heartache that comes from spending, you know, a decade and a half of your life utterly focused on this one goal that is, you know, in the end, largely outside of your control. And you know, there are other situations besides women who don't marry, but, you know, lots of people in the church for whom this focus on the heterosexual family creates a great deal of pain. And, you know, as near as I can tell, the gospel is about alleviating those kinds of pain as well as all the other kinds. And we could do a better job if we thought more about kinship in this way.
Wow, that is terrific. And you said, you know, if young women, you know, were this was brought into them, obviously it would be great for men too, but I can see what you're saying, especially largely out of control.
Well,
yeah, in some ways it would maybe encourage more young women, more women who are maybe in their late 20s or early 30s to go to the temple ahead of time to receive their endowment. Would you say that?
Well, yeah, and I think a lot of women do, but because our only discussion of the temple, especially for women, I mean, boys go before their missions, usually.
Right.
And so for them, it does have this idea of, you know, being endowed with power for a particular job, for a mission. And for girls, you know, some young women do go in preparation for a mission, but most go either, you know, in preparation for marriage or as sort of a consolation prize when marriage has not materialized. You know, I mean, there's this sort of painful surrender, I think, in going to the temple on your own with no prospect of marriage. And that need not be.
No prospect of eternal sealing to who you are married to, because we do have that case of women at a certain point in their life that they're married to a non-member or someone who doesn't want to go to the temple, but they still go ahead and get endowed.
Right, right. But there's this sense, and which can be reinforced by the fact that by the structure of the temple ritual itself, which it, you know, does sort of heavily emphasize the heterosexual couple at the center of it. But, you know, that inevitable, you know, disappointment maybe is reinforced by the fact that particularly for women, marriage is the best reason to go to the temple, and every other reason is bound up with this disappointment and lack of a partner to go with. And, you know, if we thought of it more broadly as becoming part of a family, you know, a big kinship network rather than a heterosexual dyad, there would be less pain in that sort of resignation of going for some other reason than marriage.
I love it. Taylor, any follow-up there?
Well, I think Christine points to, you know, a number of problems that we face culturally with people who live in lives which do not conform to the particular norms that we teach. You know, part member families, single men and women. We can think of, you know, other kinds of heterosexual families which don't conform in certain ways, where there's a child from a previous marriage who cannot be sealed to the new wife, even though the parents are sealed. There are all kinds of ways in which these lives that are lived now are often impeded by these teachings rather than helped and enabled and sustained. And I think that there are ways that we might be able to think of accommodating other kinds of people whose lives don't conform to the particular ways that we've been teaching that will help them and sustain them and reach out to them and think of them as real members of our community. You know, even, you know, people who are, they're all of their children are gone, don't think about marriage and family in the same ways that it often gets idealized in our talks and in our, you know, Mother's Day and Father's Day and all of these kinds of things. And I think that we're missing a huge portion of our existing community, let alone the people who end up leaving precisely because they don't feel like they fit. So I appreciate Christine's thoughts on that. I think that she is absolutely right.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
All is well.